everybody, and welcome to another episode of Tech Can't Save Us, episode 2 of season 3, and where we're focusing on everything London and UK tech in honour of London Tech Week. I'm your co-host, William Gadsby-Pete. Unfortunately, Paul couldn't join us today, so it's just going to be me and Rebecca. Rebecca, how are you doing?
I'm not too bad, Will. I'm excited for London Tech Week. We're here in the midst of it all, and you know, it's been quite an eye-opening experience, so I'm looking forward to covering some more of that on today's episode.
It's been awesome. We've been absolutely in the weeds with some very, very cool tech brands, some really cool niche sectors, and some really exciting London startups, including the wonderful Dami Hastrup, who we've got an interview for you later with. He's the co-founder of Moonhub. They do all things VR and VR training. Very, very cool. We've actually got a deep dive on today's podcast on UK and the AR and VR scene. We're going to be doing a quick spotlight on the UK government's Web3 and metaverse strategy. And finally, we're going to be looking at AI and its existential threat to humanity. Looking at the UK government's sort of tightening of legislation and its sort of quite alarmist statement it released this month with, we're now doing a summit on AI and whether we're okay with it or not. Cool. Well, let's get to the news. Kicking us off, we are focusing on UK, AR and VR, all the acronyms. But the UK's VR and AR market is estimated to reach $1.2 billion by the end of this year. So yeah, what's driving that growth? Who are some of the leading UK companies to look out for? And what are the things we should all keep an eye on in the next 5 years in terms of sort of mass market AR and VR? Obviously had the huge news that Apple's releasing its Vision Pro, which has got a lot of people very excited. Rebecca, what did you think of that? Like normally when Apple releases a product, especially a product that's cost that much money, they've done a lot of research. You know, they think it's a real goer in the market. They don't make many mistakes. So it seems to signal sort of the next phase of evolution of AR and VR, doesn't it?
It most definitely does. And I think it's really interesting because I think even we've done a few blog posts on these kind of tech mammoths who come into the scene and I don't want to say copy or replicate, but really kind of bring to the surface things that have been going on for years prior. So when I saw that Apple was releasing the Vision Pro headset, my first thoughts were, they've cottoned on. And my second thoughts were, we will now see kind of an influx of other tech giants replicating and bringing forth this kind of VR technology to the forefront of people's minds. I am excited about it though, because I think it provides a lot of opportunities for different businesses and in the corporate world, but also I think it provides opportunities for people on a personal level. And if it is bringing an accessible VR kind of headset or technology to the homes and lives of kind of regular people, then I'm here for it, because I think it can only kind of further us as a people, if used correctly, of course. But yeah, I'm excited to see how it develops and how it's received, more importantly, by the wider mass. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what they actually do in the coming years with it.
No, 100%. I mean, there is just something about like when big brands go in, like, you know, there's tech out there comparable to the Apple Vision Pro, stuff like the HoloVision 1 and 2, which Microsoft led. But, you know, Apple does just do things better. And like even just watching their launch videos and stuff, you know, it did get me excited about VR and AR in a way that I hadn't really been since I was like a child watching sci-fi. So yeah, you know, the really, really cool features that they went into, like where, you know, you'll be in the middle of watching something and you'll have this giant 100-inch cinema screen projected in front of you. But then the headset will notice that someone's walked up to you. It will stop that. It will clear open and give and this is kind of terrifying but really cool, the front of the mask will produce a digital representation of your eyes to look as real as possible, and it will then show you the user, the person in front of you. So
that's,
yeah,
insane.
So a lot of this stuff is very scary. Maybe AI will destroy the world. at the same time, we are living through like literally the Jetsons, and that's really fucking cool. Mm. And I like the little child inside of me can't help but be like, rah. On the more serious level, like, you know, what are some, you know, you touched upon some of the things that you're excited to see VR and AR do. What do you think is fueling that growth? Like what industries, both in the personal and the professional, like what are the kind of things that are getting people so excited? Why are VCs putting so much money into it? Why is it, you know, estimated to get into the billions at the end of this year?
I think there are quite a few industry that it does touch, but I think one, like for my own opinion, I would definitely say the security industry. I think that's a massive industry that could benefit from VR in terms of like training, of course, simulation, etc. Also health. I think that's an area that is evolving daily and is becoming really important to our day-to-day life. And I think when these companies actually realize that VR could be such a great contributor to these industries, I think that those two really spring to mind when you say what industries are pushing this. I think we're really looking at the industry being massive, and we need to look at these huge kind of cyber security, health, I would say, even education. They would be my top three in terms of industries that could benefit from VR.
100%. If you ever look at any HR infographics on how you teach people information, which unfortunately I do, at least I did. I never used to, and then start a fucking company, and now I look at them all the time. There are several stages to how you learn and how you retain information, and like, you know, what you learn from reading a book versus doing the skill is like, you know, reading the book will give you 10% of the skill set, doing the thing will give you 90%. And I do think VR and AR manages to combine those two together. Like, you know, some of the places that it's been being used for a very long time, you know, it's things like, well, very long time, 5 years, which in today's tech world is a very long time.
That is ancient.
you know, it's stuff like heart surgeons, really intense machinery that if you make a mistake with is a very big problem, like cranes, you know, stuff where you just can't learn it in a book, but if you're training someone in person and they mess up, you know, it's a real problem. And you used to have these giant simulators for stuff like flights and pilots, and you know, instead you can do it for a fraction of the cost but just as much efficacy with VR and AR. This is where I get quite excited about it, is like, I think it gives the chance for human empathy in a way that people, you just, like, you know, as a white man, I can just never understand what it's like to be wolf whistled, like, or, you know, or deal with sexism in the workplace. I think through VR, like DEI training can suddenly become so much more powerful to teach, you know, people that have never experienced a certain type of discrimination what it might actually be like, how awful it is to go through that, so that, you know, it, again, in a way that like a webinar session just never is.
And also, Will, you mentioned something important there about your own experience, and you actually, you know, run a digital agency. We are a remote digital agency. So how do you, as somebody who is in this position, envision that VR could potentially kind of increase the productivity within your global team, you know, in the future? How could you see it helping that situation as well?
Oh, so I, you know, work calls it awful. Like people hate, you know, Zoom fatigue is a real thing.
Yeah.
And when I look at my calendar for a day and I have like 5 hours of back-to-back digital calls, you know, a little bit of you dies inside.
Of course.
And quite often they're not that useful. They're not that productive. Mm. Like, we've worked very hard as an agency to stop anyone booking stuff in that isn't absolutely vital to be a face-to-face. Mm. But yeah, I really do think if everyone has headsets in that situation, even if it's just a Zoom, but there's more of a virtual interactive environment built around the screen that people are looking at.
Yeah.
You know, I do think that's one of the key areas that, like, the Vision Pro has the potential to revolutionize. But I also just think someone is eventually going to invent a better version of Zoom, because the call software that we're all using since the pandemic just isn't actually very good and no one really enjoys it. So yeah, I think that's one of the biggest things, is just like, you know, everyone post-pandemic has moved towards this sort of remote model, at very least hybrid. I know very few people still in fully physical roles.
Yeah.
But the technology hasn't quite caught up with them, and I think this is a big step in the right direction. So yeah, that's the thing I'm most excited about. But, you know, I like other things, like, yeah, being able to put on a headset and watch my favorite movie with spatial audio and giant 100-screen, like, that's very, very cool.
That is,
like,
a vibe.
Yeah, 100%. Like, it might not revolutionize work, but it's going to be fucking cool.
Yeah, it will, for sure. It is exciting, and I think there are so many good things to come from it, but I think it's hard for big companies and even individuals, I think there's a little bit of a scaremongering agenda going on as well. I mean, we're having this, as you mentioned previously, this huge AI summit in the autumn where they are going to try and call for regulations and really try and put into question the kind of the ethical, I don't want to say limitations on, not specifically VR, but I would say AI in general and everything that comes under that. So I think with that in mind, it does kind of make you think, will all these big companies be susceptible to taking on VR headsets? Do you think it will be something that is easily rolled out in the corporate world? Do you think there'll be a little bit of pushback? And again, something like going off that as well, do you feel that maybe the government might look to do more for the technology industry with those things in mind?
Yeah, I think the mass market has been very excited by AR and VR for decades. It's just the technology's never been able to live up to its promise. I think we're finally seeing that. You know, I was at the HR Tech conference a couple weeks ago in the XL, and half of the stalls exhibiting were involving some form of VR or AR in terms of how you train your team. So, you know, I do think big companies are moving there quickly.
Yeah.
But yeah, in terms of the government's role in all this, I think... actually, recently, I think we're living off the sort of glories of past investment in the UK tech sector, but there is a lot to be optimistic about in terms of where VR and AR in particular are in the UK. You know, we speak to Dami later, who's part of a wave of UK founders doing really, really cool stuff with the tech.
Yeah.
You know, in Guildford, you've got NDreams, and like Guildford is known as the Hollywood of gaming in the UK. Mm. You know, you've got a huge amount of companies doing really cool stuff with VR, AR, Unreal Engine, building like virtual worlds, building gaming worlds, building you know, film sets for stuff like The Mandalorian. You know, you've got Improbable in London building metaverses, Moon Hub with VR and AR training, and a few other folk. Yeah, I think the UK scene right now is in a very good place. I think, as usual, the government with regards to AR and AR will continue to sort of like jump on the buzzwords, maybe do some form of tax benefits or investment, but nothing really massive.
Major, no.
Like, you know, they've not been truly tech forward for I'd say the last 3 or 4 years, in my personal opinion. Don't at me. But yeah, I think really we are in a good place. The UK is in a really good place, and I think it will only go from strength to strength. I'm really excited about how much of the sort of cool stuff and innovation we're talking about will happen within London and the UK. And you know, there are plenty of other tech hubs, you know, like in Edinburgh and you know, Leeds and Manchester, like we spoke about in the last episode, that have also got their own little VR and AR hubs, and are, you know, creating immersive experiences. They're creating trainings. They're creating games. So yeah, it's an exciting time. And yeah, the UK government's strategy for Web3 and the metaverse, where we were just talking about the government. This is off the back of the announcement that the UK's new Department of Science, Innovation and Technology has been tasked with putting together a strategy that will ensure Britain leads the future on web technology, sometimes known as Web3 or the metaverse.
Well, I need to stop you there, because what exactly is that department? What does it mean? Like, what, when you hear that, what do you think about? Because I hear that and I just think it doesn't even sound real. What are they trying to achieve with this department, do you think?
Well, I mean, they're trying to achieve the replacement of a bunch of other organisations that were doing a much better job. Like, I would very much like to be proven wrong, but yeah, the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology does sound like something a politician would dream up, just having looked at a bunch of buzzwords. And it will probably do very little. And the fact that it's immediately going after like Web3, AI and all of the other big buzzwords in the tech sector, to me just suggests, you know, this is a thing run by 50-year-old politicians who have no idea what the hell.
Not ageist.
Yeah, no, it's just like, you know, it's like, they aren't people that understand the tech sector. And if they would, they wouldn't have fucking got rid of Tech London.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is one of the very first statements. They're going to, you know, come up with ways to lead the future of web technology, sometimes known as Web3 or the metaverse. And it's just like,
give us a break.
Pretty empty statement. Yeah. This is something that most companies are struggling with, most governments are struggling with. Like, I mean, what do you think the challenges for it? Say that we take them at their word and they really are trying to do this. What do you think are some of the kind of the fat challenges facing that department? You know, what does success look like? How do they have a hope in hell?
I think if we're being honest about how they can be successful, it really needs to be about making London and the UK in general a comfortable space for startups. And when I say comfortable, I mean in terms of startups being able to access grants, funding. We spoke in the last episode, you know, about all those kinds of things that the removal of Tech Nation is meaning for a lot of startups and tech companies. So I think they really need to start there. That would be, for me, the ideal in success, looking at those kind of factors that contribute to having London as the tech, one of the, I think it's the third largest tech hub in the world. So having London as a third largest tech hub, what contributes to that, and how can they continue to ensure that we are still in that position? Because, you know, and you said this last episode, actually, you said that in a few years, we could be old news. And I really do think that that's real. So I think if they want to be successful, it's best that they look at how to keep us at the top.
Yeah, I mean, I think my massive skepticism comes from, I don't think governments have done a good job of regulating social media, and social media has been around for 20 years. I don't think they have a hope in hell of regulating something or even encouraging something that changes literally every week. I mean, like, you know, every week I get a newsletter with a new AI tool. I'm just like, fucking hell, could you calm down? Like, this is moving at such an insanely rapid pace. Same with metaverses. It seems like a new one pops up every day and another one goes bust every day. You know, every month you're hearing about what the new metaverse is that you should invest in and buy land in. But yeah, I think, I mean, honestly, I think the problem they'll have is the problem they have with everything, which is like, how do you bring together all of the sort of people that do understand this world, and then give them the funding and the tools that they need to build it for you, and understand that you, as the role of government, just aren't going to ever have the expertise to sort of like set the agenda and set the policy. Like, it's to put regulations on people in a way that doesn't stop them from thriving, but stops them from doing evil.
I don't know. It's really hard, isn't it? Because I think, to add to your skepticism, we're kind of going into this question about what kind of works for them. And I think that worries me a little bit, because I have good reason to question the government's intentions and their thoughts and the things that they do. So I wonder, when they do come to this place of trying to regulate something, which in my opinion can't really be regulated, as you said, every week we're seeing something new, something different, things are falling by the wayside left, right and center. But I think it really calls into question, what's their agenda? What do they want out of it, and how will that serve them? And I think once we establish that, then we'll kind of know, okay, this is what the government will do. And it's a scary place to be in a little bit.
I am worried about the lack of real, what I personally perceive as the lack of real interest by the government of truly engaging with this in a meaningful way. Mm-hmm. Is it really is something that needs regulation and needs a government that has enough expertise, at least hired, like consultancy expertise hired in, to regulate it? Because it, you know, it is quite a scary place, and there's a lot of potential. Like, you know, Web3 is happening whether you want it or not. Yeah. A large part of Web3 is built on incredibly complex encryption that makes it pretty much, like, you know, some debate on this, but pretty much impossible to track data unless people specifically give you the you know, permission to do it. And quite a lot of the places which that has been the case on the internet have not turned out well, you know, like 4chan, you know, the dark web. There's a lot of really horrible shit that happens there, and you know, Web3 does have the potential for a lot of good things. I'm not, you know, just shitting on Web3.
Yeah.
But it does also have the potential to very easily build social platforms, websites, just digital infrastructure that anyone can access from their phone or a laptop that is completely untraceable and therefore totally unregulatable. Mm. And there are some people that, you know, there are ways you can build through smart contracts essentially a regulated environment without tracking everyone's data. Mm. But they are very, very difficult to do. And quite often people say they have done them, and in fact, there's actually a rug pull and there is one central person that can see all the data and is doing something very funky with it. It's a scary place, and I really hope that we're completely wrong and the Department of Science, Innovation and Technology actually does commit to sort of, you know, understanding the sector, investing in it, but also putting the brakes on from some of the scariest stuff. But I would be surprised if that's the case. I mean, from what we've seen from all of the other tech niches where the government tends to have tried to sort of involve itself, is they don't really understand it, and they definitely don't do a good job of regulating. And then eventually you get one unicorn that makes so much money it starts lobbying the government, and the government just does whatever that tech unicorn, you know, asks them to. And that's also not a good place. Unfortunately, we're going to continue shitting on the UK government. Do you want to intro the third and final topic?
Well, the third and final topic, we've kind of touched on it already, but you know, I think the third and final topic is ultimately about anarchy in the UK and what is
spelled AI. Anarchy. I was very happy when I came up with that. So just for the listener, anarchy. It doesn't really work when you don't see it written down, and I've completely fucked this because it's an audio format. But trust me, that was a really good joke when I wrote it down about a week ago.
But what is the UK government doing in terms of tightening legislation? Why do so many people think that it poses an existential threat? And also, what are the UK's top AI startups that are making waves around the globe? We've kind of touched on legislation, but I don't know if we're going to get a solid answer on that one until we kind of sort out our situation in government at the moment. I think once we are able to have, without being too political, after the elections, let's put it that way, after the election, when we do have a new government and hopefully we kind of enter this era of stability in government and politics, because I think in the UK it's fair to say we haven't had that for a while.
Yes, we put this section in as off the back of a UK government's recent announcement, and this is kind of classic of our current government. Jeremy Hunt announced this Department of Science, Innovation and Technology and how it was going to help Britain lead the future on web technology, sometimes known as Web3 in the metaverse. And then, like, literally about a week later, the government sort of released a statement saying we're very concerned about AI and the impact it's going to have on our society. So yeah, I think government's in a bit of a bind at the moment. Like, it always wants to encourage free market capitalism to try and, you know, tax dollars, well, pounds even, out of the startups that do make it. But at the same time, I do think AI, if you listen to a certain side of the argument, does pose an existential threat to what it means to be a society and a government. And this is very much up for debate, and I think we'll really see in the next 5 years. But the leaps and bounds that AI has taken on in the last 6 months, let alone the last 6 years, does start to suddenly actually put into possibility some of the sci-fi scenarios people always talked about. Yeah, right now you can't use ChatGPT to write a book, but I mean, like, I am pretty confident you will be able to in a couple of years, given how much it's coming on in leaps and bounds. And it does then put you into a bit of a sort of question of, okay, well, if all of my 90% of my economy is staffed by office workers, and AI and automation has just taken, let's say, 50% of those out of work, what next? Like, does capitalism still work? Do we have an economy? Like, how do you navigate such a pivotal shift in how your society is made up? And I do think that's the thing that's starting to scare them a little, is like, there's a certain school of thought that's like, hey, in 10 years, you know, the Britain that you know right now genuinely might not exist in a way that it has.
Yeah.
And that's what's making them shit the bed, I think, a little.
I think it's hard as well, because we're not just dealing with the kind of rapid evolution of technology and everything related to it, but you have to get people's minds round to that as well. And I think that that's much harder to do. And I think if the minds of the people, and I think the majority of people are aware of what's going on with AI, VR, AR, etc., I just think that not everyone grasps how rapid and how vast the technology is. So I think, yeah, you're talking about in 10 years time we're going to have a very different looking society, and I wonder myself what will be my role.
And it is, you know, there's a sort of I can't remember what this model's called, but it talks about how, like, every tech revolution speeds up each time it happens. So, you know, there's like literally 2,000 years between us discovering, like, bronze and us discovering steel or whatever. It's so much so that you name the ages after the materials that you figured out as humans how to use. Then there's like literally 10 years from the internet being invented to everyone having a device in their pocket that can access it.
Yeah.
And everyone using social media. Then it seems like every 3 years there's a revolution. And now with AI, like, you know, the government released a white paper on AI about 2 months ago. It's all already like hilariously out of date just up in like 2 months. And so you're talking about like, you know, in 10 years time, what a society look like. And it really is. And in my personal opinion, starting to look at the realm of sci-fi in terms of, you know, 10 years previously was 2013. The tech available to you in 2013 was a joke. Like, it was so bad. And in 2033, you really could, if you wanted to, automate a huge amount of the workforce with AI and probably do a better job. Like, you could automate all food production with the technology we have available to us today, let alone in 10 years' time. You could automate so much office work. So many of the things that we thought were like AI proof in terms of creativity, we're being shown time time again already, like with what's available on the mass market in terms of ChatGPT.
And that leads us nicely into the next section, where we are joined by Dami Hastrup of Moon Hub. We are going to be talking all things VR and looking into some really interesting things inspired by our time here at London Tech Week. So don't go anywhere, because that's up next.
We spoke to you on the email thread. We're doing like a fun sort of London and UK tech focus in honor of kind of London Tech Week next week. So you fit really lovely into that.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. I'm looking forward to London Tech Week. I think it's always a really vibrant time within the London tech ecosystem. I know that there's always a lot going on. I think the first time we ever featured there was in 2019, but we were at Plextal at the time. And we also were featured alongside, I think, McLaren and a few other companies. Felt a bit rogue at the time because we were so early in our journey, but it was great.
That's awesome, man. That must have been such a cool moment for you.
It was, yeah. And the Prime Minister at the time came to visit us as well, so that was really cool.
It's a sad state of UK politics. Who the hell was the Prime Minister in 2019?
Yeah. So that was, goodness, only just about 4 years ago, but it was Theresa May.
That
was only 4 years ago. So what should be one term, yeah. And I don't know how many Prime Ministers we've had in between. Goodness, isn't it? It's four Prime Ministers we've had since then, right? Including her. It's four, I think.
So yeah, it was Cameron, May, Johnson, the one that we don't speak
Truss,
and now... The one that we all just kind of pretend didn't happen.
Goodness, yeah. So it was a while ago, but, well, not even that long ago, but since then, including her, there have been four prime ministers, which is something else. But yeah, great to be here. Another London Tech Week coming up.
Amazing. Well, I think we should get started and dive in. I really wanted to give our listeners the chance to kind of understand yourself a little bit better, Dami, and Moon Hub in general. So if you could, please just let us know and let the listeners know exactly who you are in terms of your background and just a little bit about Moon Hub and exactly what Moon Hub does.
For sure. So hi, everyone who's listening. My name's Dami Hastrup. I'm the founder and CEO of Moon Hub. Outside of the company, my background is in economics, and I taught myself how to code in C#. And gain proficiency in Unity, the game engine. My hobbies are things from playing guitar to working out, playing sports, etc. But within the world of business, I founded Moon Hub soon after I graduated university. I realized that training in all the places I either done internships or actual work in was just inconsistent. But there was one thing that was consistent, and that people didn't remember anything, right? You'd spend so much time training, but people just didn't remember anything. So I thought there has to be a better way of delivering information. And that was, in my opinion, an immersive learning platform, because you wouldn't have to read, comprehend, and then decipher what those things mean. You'd essentially be able to immerse yourself in those real life environments and situations. And wouldn't it be even better if you could gain some data and insights as to how well you're performing in those environments? So 6.5 years ago, I set out with this kind of crazy vision to essentially bring that theory to life. And 6.5 years later, we're working with companies like Zurich Insurance, Just Eat, Amazon, and a number of others to bring them virtual reality training in a number of different ways. And this VR immersive platform has been allowing companies to, basically get far more return on investment for their learning and development spend. And the reason for this is because when you learn in VR, you retain up to 75% of the information rather than typically 5%. You also train up to 4 times faster, and you can actually save up to 64% of your costs at scale. So it's a slam dunk win all around. So our hunch was proven right when all these studies came out about 4 years after we founded the company. So I brought two co-founders on 6 months after I had founded it, and they joined in 2017 after I founded it in 2016. And it's been a great journey since then.
quick follow up, like resident educator, former educator on the team here, but like how, like why does VR, you know, why does it prove to be a more effective teaching vehicle? Like what's the sort of learning science behind it?
Typically, it's not necessarily the information that's being transferred to people, it's how it's being transferred. And a lot of the time, it doesn't take into consideration people's literacy rates, people's ability or adaptability for comprehension or reading comprehension. A lot of people necessarily don't, I wouldn't say the skill or the bandwidth, but a lot of people don't translate what they read and what they interpret into real life situations, which is why the phrase learning on the job became so popular, because people would learn in theory, but then they'd go and learn on the job afterwards, because you just have to be able to see it in front of you to be able to essentially assimilate what you're supposed to be learning. And virtual reality helps bridge that gap. We use video-based VR, and we're able to capture data as to how quickly people notice certain things, whether they're looking in the right place at the right time, their overall spatial awareness, and all of this is from a look and a click. So this allows us to bridge the gap between theory and practicality quite seamlessly. And because of the easy scoring mechanism, it's very scalable as well.
When people think of VR training, they're usually thinking of heart surgeons, people operating heavy machinery. You know, you talked about one of your biggest clients is an insurance company. How does it work for that more kind of office-based worker that's maybe a little more skills, sort of, you know, digital skills focused?
Great question. So I can't speak specifically about what they've done with us on an enterprise bespoke tier, but every company that works with us has access to our off-the-shelf library as well. And that consists of things like DEI training, health and safety, well-being, general security awareness training, slip, strip, and falls, customer service, you name it. And the reason why our training translates so well into this is because in a situation where you're meant to be noticing a microaggression or an act of discrimination, typically through e-learning, you'd be able to see a yes or a no answer as to whether or not somebody selected the right answer to the question. So is this a microaggression, yes or no? Within our scenarios and within our training, you can also get, okay, were they looking in an area where that microaggression was likely to happen? How quickly did they notice it? Were they aware of their surroundings at all times? And was their intuition spot on? It gives you a whole new layer and depth of information that you normally wouldn't get through traditional e-learning. And that's translatable to a number of different things. So for example, with health and safety, slips, trips, and falls, are people perceptive to their environments? And it also gives you more confidence in the data that you get from e-learning to essentially lean on that and empower you to make more well-informed decisions, either as an L&D manager, a CLO, or somebody who's just running a training course for their team.
Okay, that's super interesting. And I think just even going back to what you said previously in your answer, you were saying that you founded MoonHub in 2016 and it didn't really start becoming, VR didn't really become a thing until 4 years later. How would you say in that time that you've actually been able to develop and really kind of pioneer this VR technology? Would you say that there's been a lot of changes in the years after, or would you say that it's been slow and stagnant until recently?
I don't know why, but people in the industry, especially within the tech journalism industry, I'm not going to name publications, but everyone loves to harp on about the death of VR. Yeah. I think VR's died 10 times now. It must be really stubborn to still be alive. Yeah. Right? But I don't know what the agenda is. It's very strange. But you know, VR, when I started it, wasn't necessarily super cool. Still arguably isn't for some people. But when it comes to like the growth of the industry, it's such a powerful concept, right? Immersing yourself or layering a new level of interactivity over what your eyes see, be it through mixed reality or extended reality, XR, or be it just straight VR. And when we started in 2016, VR as a concept was still very niche. And in the 4 years up until we commercialized, which was in 2020, what we saw was a lot of people starting to pay attention to what was happening in the space, but it still wasn't a lot. During the pandemic, it was interesting because a lot of companies were basically forced to think about innovative ways to deliver solutions from having meetings like Zoom. I'm not sure if Riverside, this software we're using, was born during the pandemic, but it definitely would have seen a ramp up during that as well. Yeah. Companies found ways to be more innovative and found that in that time as well, VR wasn't just a gimmick or anything like that. It was actually incredibly useful, which we'd all been saying for a while. But the beauty of it was that it's continued to trend upwards since then. So there are tons of studies that show that even in the consumer or entertainment sector, this bit of tech is one of the fastest growing, if not the fastest growing bits of tech. But in enterprise training, we're also seeing a massive uptick in people using VR to train. And between 2020 and now, we've been seeing a steady growth in the popularity of using VR in corporate learning. But with Apple's recent announcement as well, I think the floodgates have completely opened. I think people are I mean, when Apple bets on tech, it usually is there to stay, right? And there are so many bits of tech out there that Apple hasn't bet on. So betting on the future of immersive technology shows that it's been around for a while, regardless of the how many funerals has the tech world held for immersive tech, and it's still around. And now one of the biggest tech companies in the world is now doubling down on it as well. So it's in a very exciting space.
Yeah, I was at the HR tech conference in the Excel, and like pretty much every other stall was offering sort of some form of immersive AR or VR sort of like training in their pitch. So like, yeah, like you said, I think it's totally broken that kind of niche and interesting to, yeah, this is just in the cusp of going mainstream. And yeah, like you said, when I saw Apple sort of bet on it, I was like, oh shit, I would be so interested to see what market data they're looking at, because yeah, they don't really ever flop. Like everything they release like ends up being the sort of genre defining version of it. So yeah, I'm like, that was when I started to like really take notice in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, it really has taken off. And yeah, it's great to see so many companies coming into the world of VR training as well. Because I know often at times people think that competition isn't great. I think competition is fantastic, because in competition, it breeds innovation. And yeah, also don't be too surprised, but I'm pretty sure a large number of them will be subcontracting to companies like MoonHub, but they won't be saying it. But we'll leave that for another day.
Just on to what you're saying before, if anyone ever says to you that something is dead while they're talking to you, they're trying to sell you something. Like anytime someone's like, Facebook's dead, VR's dead, always a bullshit, always trying to sell you something.
Yeah, I agree.
And on the second point, yeah, would love to hear, like, you know, you talked about like there has been a bit of an explosion of competition. What do you think are kind of some of the things that makes MoonHub unique, and, you know, does set good VR and good AR away from just sort of, you know, the rest of the crowd?
So we've based a lot of what we do around our patented scoring system, just how we capture data. And without going too much into it on a public form of media, and it allows us to train people. Oh, trust me, because people are trying to find out.
Yeah.
But we do it, then it makes it scalable. It makes it just, yeah, really easy to onboard yourself and use. And it allows for companies to gain very valuable data and insight pieces on how people are performing, basically making it feel as familiar as technology that they already have. And that's the key to having the masses adopt something.
You know, you obviously got a unique vantage point. Have you got seeing anything coming down the pipeline from yourself or from others that is going to be like a really big, exciting thing that's going to make waves in VR?
Yes.
Good answer.
Fair enough.
I saw on LinkedIn you posted your comments about, you know, the new Apple VR headset, and I think you've kind of cemented yourself in tech in VR as a really respected opinion and perspective. As somebody who is in this VR landscape, how do you manage the expectations just on a personal level away from business? How do you keep level-headed and just ensure that you're staying grounded?
That's a really interesting question. And I've not really thought of it in that sense of being a respected opinion. I mean, it's nice to hear. I know that I'm definitely one of the more listened to voices, but I'm also in the market like everybody else. So I think because I'm quite close, I keep my ear to the ground. I am very close with a lot of the providers like Meta, like Pico. We've got a working ISV with Meta at the moment. So we're an independent software vendor to them. I think the only training one in Europe, I'm not sure, but we're very close and we keep close to the market. So it allows us to learn iteratively all the time about what's happening. On a personal level, I don't know. I think when it comes to my focus, I just keep in on the company and what I can do to try and keep pushing the company forward. And it's going really well. But I also have my VCs on my board to keep me very grounded. So don't worry about that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Curious about that. You started to mention, you know, a bit of your team, your VCs, your board. Curious to hear about, you know, like some of the success you've seen is definitely a result of, you know, collective expertise and vision brought by you and your co-founders. So is it Vin and Hannah? Am I saying that right?
Vin and Hannah. Yeah. My co-founders.
Yeah, we'd love to see if you could elaborate on just like what are the specific areas of expertise that each of you bring to MoonHub, and how has that diverse skill set contributed to the overall success of the company?
Yeah, of course. So Vin and Hannah, I brought them on about 6 months after I founded the company. We've been best friends for a long time. We all lived together at one point actually as well, and worked from the same dining table. We were really in bootstrap mode. And yeah, I mean, the diverse skill set that we bring is, you know, it's quite interestingly balanced. So Hannah is very operationally minded, but she has expertise and like experience in international sales. She's trilingual and, you know, has did that before MoonHub. Vin had a lot of expertise in retail management and overseeing operations when it came to training on that side as well, but also taught himself how to code and develop in Unity. And then myself, I come from a business background. So my parents own businesses, respectively, of their own. So I grew up watching them from the ground up build those. And I think the three of us, with our expertise coming together, we're able to balance each other quite well. So it was a very diverse skill set. We also make the joke, I'm not sure if it's a great joke, but we're also very diverse as a co-founding trio. So we always make the joke that we look like the front of a university brochure. It goes down well in some.
That's really good.
Goes down well in some pitches, not so well in others. But some VCs have a sense of humor. But yeah, and our board, I mean, we have great VCs on board. And I'm not just saying that because they would be listening to this, but I have great VCs on board. They do keep us grounded and, you know, really showcase like, okay, yes, they think we're a great company, but there is an expectation that comes with that and growth that comes with that. And it allows us to really not pat ourselves on the back too much, but continuously look at how we can make better changes and iterative changes to our product so that we can continue to get more and more clients on board in a nice, swift fashion. So yeah, it's been a nice balance of people external, but also internally.
Shout out to Moonhubs VCs listening in.
Yes.
Hello, hope you're having a good day.
having a wonderful time saying wonderful things about you all.
Yes. Have you found it? Because me and Paul have this, we're co-founders, and it's an interesting dynamic. And like me and Paul also were kind of friends before starting the company. So have you navigated like, you know, being mates beforehand, but then a business relationship and kind of making sure like it can, I've seen it go to one of two ways. It's either the best thing ever and it really works for the company, or it's a total disaster. Great to see Moonhubs manage to get the former, not the latter. But how has it been navigating that kind of transition from personal to professional?
I think it's not necessarily breaking that initial part of being friends, because I think that's actually quite important to maintaining that relationship throughout. A company will go through tough times. If there's a company that hasn't been through tough times, they are either the best like business moguls in the world or incredibly, incredibly lucky. But when a company falls on hard times or things are looking very tough, you need people that you can also trust as well. So, you know, things won't necessarily be going super well, but you know that when you make a decision, your co-founders will trust that you're making this decision in the best interest of the company. Or when they're making a decision, you're trusting that there's no personal gain to be had or there's no ulterior motives, because the three of you trust each other. That can happen even though you're not friends, but it's more often than not, you can trust them if you trusted them before you started the company with them.
Yeah, really resonates.
Disagreements will happen though. Disagreements always happen, but it's better to disagree with somebody that you're like, all right, cool, disagreement's over, let's go for a pint.
Yeah, disagree but trust. We kicked off our first month of season three with a pure focus on sort of London tech and UK tech in honor of London Tech Week. So yeah, we'd just love to, you know, London has been working hard to emerge as a bit of a hub of VR and AR, and there's a couple of other kind of VR hubs in the UK. So we'd just love to hear kind of in your experience, like what is it unique about the London tech scene that's offered a good thriving environment and a launch pad for VR and AR companies?
You know, I've got a bit of an interesting opinion on this. I'm not sure how it's received, but I think London is a fantastic city for tech because of the entrepreneurs in it. I know that we're sung about by official bodies, etc., how much help we get. I'm going to keep my mouth closed on that. But in terms of like us as an ecosystem making a way and paving a way for ourselves, I think it's great, right? So for example, I was part of the Google Black Founders Fund last year, and that was a fantastic initiative by Google. And as a result of that, the founders themselves, we continue to talk till this day. We set up things like dinners and networking events to continue to empower other founders as well. And things like that, just they happen in a city like London, you know, it just happens like that. And you do, I mean, to be fair, you do have some very good state-run initiatives as well, like the London and Partners Group and others. But you know, it's one of those things where I think the entrepreneurs and then also the ecosystem here just breeds creativity and collaboration as well. Everyone is in quite close proximity to each other. And London is quite a bit of a melting pot. From Dalston, you can be in South London within 20 minutes, and that's a completely different ecosystem down there. From South London, you can be in East London within, you know, a few minutes, and you're in an entirely different ecosystem there. So it really is just a case of you have different kind of people, different kind of sectors within arm's reach, no matter where you are.
You based out of Dalston?
No, so I'm based out of Hackney. So we're in Hackney Wick area. I say Dalston because that's, I know there's like a hub over there as well. Haggerston has a few, but Hackney, but everywhere in Hackney is very trendy and tech savvy. But then I know that South London has a lot of things popping up now as well.
Love that.
Yeah, it's exciting.
It is, definitely. I mean, we spoke about London, and I think it's interesting because we've just heard that the UK is about to hold its first summit on AI, and that will happen in the autumn. So I just want to get your opinion on any kind of ethical considerations, especially within MoonHub. How are you addressing any potential ethical concerns? Do you have any, you know, such as privacy, data? Are those things a worry to you at all, or not really?
I think when it comes to artificial intelligence, I mean, the thing is, AI is a word that's been used for so long, right? If you have an algorithm that just learns in one iteration from something else, it's been AI for a while. I think in the way that it's been popularized nowadays, yes, it's come in leaps and bounds. So OpenAI and ChatGPT has completely revolutionized how people think about machine learning. In terms of concerns around data, I mean, we don't use AI a whole lot at MoonHub at the moment. We do use it for some things, not just GPT, but and for people listening, it's a generative pre-trained transformer. Basically, it can learn as it goes. But we use other elements of machine learning as well. But I think technology is only as ethical as the people using it. I think that it, no matter what, right, you'll have tech being used for good, but that same bit of tech can be used for not so good things. And, you know, I think when it comes to data, or even with this AI summit that the government is running and hosting, the technology is absolutely fantastic. And the government almost likely hired out contracts, etc. I just, yeah, very important to watch who those contracts go to. More importantly, who owns the companies for those contracts. But that's all I'll say on that.
No, I think that's really interesting. And within, especially within the world of VR, like, you know, you kind of touched upon it before, that some of the stuff that people initially got really excited about was like, yeah, here is the closest way you could ever start to truly understand some of these issues around, like, obviously you'll never really have that lived experience, but it's the best we can give you. What are some of the other kind of like industries or roles that you think it really can sort of play a critical role in just making society better? Because obviously there's always that fear of tech, but what do you think is the positive side that's getting you excited and getting you out of bed in the morning?
So when it comes to virtual reality, I think the amount of applications and opportunities it presents is incredible. I think sometimes tech founders get a reputation or a rap for being quite dystopian, and everyone must be walking around in VR headsets and, you know, whatnot. I'm very much the opposite. I love connectivity. I prefer in-person meetups than virtual. I prefer things to be as free-flowing and natural as possible. And with MoonHub, that's what we also try and push. We say, look, spend your time in front of a screen, not as much as you need to, because our training helps you do things faster. So you can take off the headset, interact with people, and, you know, discuss what you got in terms of results, etc. And what we see, what we love, is, you know, people who go through box standard corporate training, whenever we go for demos or we see them using our products in person, you have people who are, you know, their families, kids, you know, they've gone through their whole corporate career laughing for the first time ever whilst doing corporate training, because they're laughing at somebody missing out on like three different hazards, and it's like, aren't you meant to be head of health and safety? And they're all making fun of each other, and it's great because it actually is like a new center point, right? It brings people a bit closer, and they compare scores, they're more rejuvenated and excited to train. And that's something that within MoonHub we're really happy to see when people are training. But in the world of VR, I think connectivity and connecting with people in a more realistic way, it can be seen as dystopian, but I think it can also be quite inspiring. Imagining somebody, for example, who has a terminal illness, who's not able to leave their bed, but who is able to potentially connect with people on the other side of the world with, you know, Apple's new Vision Pro, and really feel like they're there, for example. Very sad situation, but one that could be even sadder without technology like that. And I think having the opportunity for things like that will inevitably happen. It's not even a case of if, it's definitely a when. And I think it will allow us to really see a new layer of the world that we have around us, but we just shouldn't go too far off the edge.
I love that. I think that that's really important. And I think sometimes you can forget that there are actually elements like the scenario you've just described that it could really help and combat. I think as well, it's important that as things move on and evolve, we're staying up to date. And how do you feel that the training content is being kept up to date within VR? Just going back to Moon Hub specifically and training modules, how are you, you know, keeping up with each industry that you serve and making sure that everything is up to date and moving with the time?
Great question. We constantly refresh our content to make sure that it's relevant to trends today. All of our content is filmed with co-collaborators who are experts in their field. So for example, for our DEI training, we partnered with Rasheen Wood. She's a former CEO of Kick It Out. She was a CEO for 10 years. For our dementia care training, we partnered with Professor Claire Sir. She's one of the leading dementia care experts in the UK. And for our, you know, off-the-shelf security training, we partnered with Core Security. They're the oldest security company in the world. Before she passed, Her Majesty the Queen was their life governess, and one of their first clients was Florence Nightingale to secure one of the hospitals or sites. So we make sure we work with, you know, the best people when we co-collaborate to create this content, and then we get it certified by the CPD service to make sure that the content is, you can basically have a certificate or a certification after you've completed the training. So we make sure that people are staying up to date with the latest trends in training, and we're constantly refreshing content. But we are growing. So we're currently a seed stage company going towards our Series A. And we have had a few prospective investors who are like, okay, what about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? And I said, don't forget, we are a seed stage company. We'll get there. But, you know, and they're like, oh, you know what? Sometimes because of the way we speak and because of who we're working with as well, sometimes they forget. But it's great to hear that because it shows that we're going in leaps and bounds towards where we need to go.
That's amazing to hear that you're instilling that like patience in investors. Obviously that's a, you know, awkward position, but you're, you know, insisting on it and saying like, hey, let's look at the longer term here. Along those lines, another nerdy learning science question for you, but just would love to hear about how you handle feedback and assessment, which are crucial for effective learning. So, you know, how do you all at Moon Hub provide feedback for learners during their training sessions? And do you have mechanisms in place to track and measure learners' progress and performance?
Absolutely. That's the bread and butter of our patented scoring system. So you're able to capture data based on a number of factors, but it's all a reactive-based scoring system. So how are people perceiving things within this environment? They don't have to do much, but we can capture a lot of data based on where they're looking and how they notice certain things. And then that's all translated to an online dashboard where they can look at things like leaderboards, scoring sort of trends, etc. And it's been well-received. Learning managers love that. And we're constantly improving it over time. So we're constantly adding new metrics to measure people against, and we test them thoroughly before rolling them out. But yeah, it's getting more and more detailed with the data that we collect.
For you personally, what's the journey been like? Like, you know, people always think of tech founders as like these kind of like, you know, monolith geniuses that just create out of nothing. But like, you know, it's very scary. And to have got, you know, like you said, in leaps and bounds to where you are today, what's that journey been like for you personally? How has it been in terms of feeling rewarded and just energized by it all?
Yeah. Do you know what? Being a founder is a very interesting journey because you'll spend half your time wondering, what am I doing? And then not in a bad way, but more in like, okay, you're probably the first one doing what you're doing in like this specific way, in specific sense. So there has to be an element of self-confidence. The most telling lesson has been, if you think you've gone over and above, perfect, you've done just about enough. there's always more work to do. It's the most humbling experience when you're like, okay, surely the amount of work, the shifts I've done, etc., that's like over and above, right? And you're like, oh no, that's the standard. And then you realize, okay, it's going to, I don't know if anyone's familiar with the philosophical tale of Sisyphus and the boulder and rolling it up the hill and the mountain, but it's essentially that you just have to learn to get used to enjoying the actual building of something. And yeah, it's interesting, we closed our seed round last year, and you know, I thought I would have been doing backflips and being like, yeah. But the first thing I thought was, right, how to get to the next stage. And we had our game plan, we had our roadmap, and we still do. But for me to have been thinking about that immediately afterwards, the dust hadn't even really settled yet, was interesting. And since then, from then till now, amazing things have happened for myself and my co-founders in terms of like certain listings that we've managed to achieve or getting funded by Google and others. And it's been great, but we've just been quite laser focused on getting to the next stage. And you do get to a point where you realize, right, there has to be a point where you're not satisfied, but there has to be a point where you say to yourself, right, yes, there's always the next goalpost, but right now I need to take a moment to take everything in as to where we are at. And that's always a bit of a struggle for founders. And it always seems from the outside that, yeah, just absolutely blitzing it and going through it. But founders fail every single day. Like a good founder will fail at something every single day because they are trying something new. And you're kind of going on an accelerated learning curve of, like, you know, especially as your company scales, a CEO of a local bakery is not the same thing as a CEO of a local cleaning company with two branches, which is not the same thing as the CEO of a microbank, which is not the same as CEO. As you scale in terms of size, your company will go through all these phases and you will have to wear a new hat each time and learn the entire time. So it's a very humbling experience, but one that has taught me a lot.
Amen to that. Learning new hats every quarter, it seems like a different, you know. Like
every quarter would be a fantastic pace. I feel like it's every week at this point.
Yeah. I can't imagine what it's like at startups. If it's anything like agencies, then yeah, wow. So
yeah, startups, especially when you're VC funded, the pace just goes through the roof. It is literally week on week. So yeah, to all founders out there as well, like VC funding is definitely the route that we wanted to go, and we still are incredibly excited about our trajectory. But I see a lot of other founders who, like, they're really going for VC funding, and you also have to stop and ask them, like, is VC funding necessarily for your company? I mean, a lot of people think of it as breathing space, and it's not at all. Like, when we got VC funding, we knew it means that we're hitting the gas to, like, go even faster. So yeah, you have to be ready to adapt and learn at breakneck speed.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time today, Dami. We really appreciate you coming on Tech Can't Save Us. And hopefully next week at London Tech Week, we might be able to meet the team and have a part two.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for having me on. And I had a great time. Thank you.
Amazing.
Thanks, Dami. I really appreciate your time.
Just before you go, Dami, where can folk find you and find Moonhub on the internet?
You can find me at Dami Hastrup, so D-A-M for mother I, H-A-S-T-R-U-P, on all handles. And then you can find us at The Moon Hub on all handles as well. And we are themoonhub.com.
Amazing.
Wonderful.
Dami, such a pleasure to meet you, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to another excellent episode of Tech Can't Save Us. If you'd love to subscribe wherever you're listening to, we would really, really appreciate it. The more subscriptions, the more reviews, the more listens we get, the cooler the guests we can get on. So please like and subscribe if you have a moment.